W-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
As you know, I like to do new cases because so many others have been widely covered that I want to make sure that I'm bringing you new content and also talking about crimes that have affected families that you might not necessarily have heard of because they're not very well widespread. Today's one of those cases. It's a really devastating one. It's literally horrific, the details of what happened to this individual. And yet, for whatever reason, like so many crimes where loved ones are taken from the families that they adore, it didn't necessarily get the coverage that it deserved. I'm going to be covering the case of the murder of David Teague. He was murdered by a man called Robert Askew. So 33-year-old David Teague was incredibly well-loved. He was known as Davey or Teague to those who knew him. I used to have a nickname, Rags, for those of you out there who want a bit of trivia. But, you know, that in itself shows you that there was clearly good friends, usually long-term friends as well when nicknames are concerned. And it certainly represents the kind of person that David Teague was. He was described by his good friends as somebody who was just an all-out brilliant dad to his three children. And that speaks volumes to me. I think that when somebody is recognised as just being a brilliant father, it kind of gives you insight into priorities, doesn't it? And I'm not saying that you cannot have been a bit of a rubbishy dad and still be a great mate. I'm just saying that when you are a great mother or father, when your children are your priority, arguably it means that you are willing to sacrifice some of your needs to make sure that your children receive what they need to receive. And he certainly represents this kind of human being. Also, one of the things that was noted by everybody is he was just one of those individuals who wasn't into conflict. He would never start fights. He never hurt anybody knowingly. He was a really gentle person. One of the things that stood out about this man was that if people confronted him, if there were arguments, if somebody was threatening, he was not an individual who would respond to violence. So he's a man after my own heart. Somebody who just accepts that altercations can occur, but it takes two of you to get engaged in one of those altercations, and he chose not to. He was said to be an individual that was just really full of life. He wanted to be friends with everybody. And he had a really close family. He was the youngest of three children, so he was the baby of the family. He grew up in Teesside, and he lived in Stockton and the Bellevue area of Middlesbrough before moving to County Durham just before Christmas 2020. I know that area very, very well. Lots of really friendly, lovely human beings, incredibly welcoming, where my husband grew up, and is a place that when we visit, I just always feel embraced. Does have its issues as well, because one of the things about the Conservative government back in the day of Maggie Thatcher was that she basically privatised everything, meaning that huge and whole industries died, and places like Middlesbrough and Stockton were certainly recipients of the decline in opportunities for employment, for example. So even though it's a wonderful place economically, it has struggled in the last 50 years, although there are lots of brilliant things changing in those areas that will make them contenders for any great city in the UK. Well, like I said, that means that life at times has been hard in those areas. David had been in a relationship with Lisa Francis for 2 years, and Lisa described this man as the love of her life, literally. She was experiencing what she considered the ultimate love affair with a man who treated her beautifully. And it wasn't just Lisa who was finding this romance something really positive in her life. Her adult daughter, Chloe Richardson, had also managed to forge and form a really great relationship with David. That speaks volumes. We all know how it can feel when somebody that is a primary caregiver gets into a relationship with another person. They are a stranger to us. Your parent might think they're the best thing since sliced bread, but that doesn't necessitate that you're going to feel the same. Chloe did. They were really close. And in fact, even though she was a mother's older daughter, the truth is that she said that David literally treated her like she belonged to him, like she was his own daughter. So as I've already said, David was really popular. He was popular, had lots of friends, but one of his many friends was 34-year-old Robert Askew. Now, he did have a nickname as well. It was Urkel. So Askew would often refer to David as his best mate. They were often seen together. And as I've said, Urkel, or Askew, was somebody who essentially nominated David to that position, said that he was the person that he relied on most. And it was a friendship that involved their partners as well, so they would often socialise together. But there is a big difference between David and Askew. There really is. Don't get me wrong, I think that this demonstrates how forgiving and accepting and compassionate David was as a human being. Because Askew is somebody who has a seriously dodgy history. And he was a sketchy person. And I think that whilst we all try to see the good in human beings, I mean, I think that's one of the things that I try to do. I know that you guys try to do. You look at people and think, what can I find is a redeeming quality? I genuinely think that some people are ugly through and through. They're ugly outside. They're ugly inside. Askew was one of these people, without a doubt. In my research, there is not a redeeming quality that I found about this human being. He'd already had 119 previous offences to his name. 119. Of those, 57 had resulted in convictions. And regarding the crime that I'm going to talk about today, at the time he committed it, he was subject to a 12-week suspended prison sentence. So he's a really high-level, consistent offender. That particular prison sentence that had been suspended was for criminal damage, but also for assault on an emergency worker on the 11th of January 2021. So automatically we think about boundaries. Attacking an emergency worker, not knowing how to behave in those circumstances, not a big consequential thinker, not really concerned about the impact of his actions to some degree, and certainly looking at that enormous history, those huge amounts of convictions in themselves demonstrates that this isn't somebody who really cares very much about the future. And that is worrying. Because if you're genuinely not concerned about your future or even having a future, then it means that you're probably not going to respect the present in the way that most of us would respect the present. You have to think about the impact you have on the moment, because if you don't, that can get you into serious trouble. For the most part, that's what remains and retains that morality that many of us feel. We understand how we should act in the world, and we understand the ramifications and consequences of not acting that way. And that does restrict some of the behaviours that at times we may wish to carry out. We've all had those thoughts, don't deny it. And that's one of the reasons why we don't act on some of the compulsions and impulses that we think in our head, because we know that there would be terrible results. Who hasn't had a situation where they've rowed with somebody and imagined something awful happening to that person? You don't want it to. You would never allow that to if it was happening in front of you. But in the moment, you think of it. But that's how we have that moral compass. And that's how we refrain and restrain ourselves from carrying out negative actions, because we're not just thinking about now. We're thinking about, well, if I act on this now, what will that mean for me next year? And so on and so forth. He's not doing that. Also, back in his history, a lot of behavioural problems, lots of issues from childhood. He was expelled from several schools, so we're not just talking about a bad day. We're not talking about he went in, got into a round with a teacher who was inappropriate, got excluded. We're talking about him repeatedly going into school and, shall we say, being asked to vacate from such an environment and institution because said behaviour was not acceptable. He then ends up working for his dad's construction company, which I would imagine is highly convenient, because if it's your son, you're going to keep them employed even when they're not necessarily the best worker. I can't imagine that he goes from being this tearaway with all these problems and criminality within his behaviour to being a diligent little worker, but I'm sure that dad wanted to keep him occupied, and also it meant that he would have some kind of steady income. However, it doesn't last forever. He ended up being unemployed at the time that we're going to talk about this crime, probably because dad got a little bit on the bored side with his behaviour. But who knows? Construction companies are one of those areas that can have lots of work at certain points and then lose work at other points, dependent on the economic climate. So it could just be that he didn't have a job in that moment because there wasn't enough opportunity. He had a history, on top of all the things that I've just talked to you about, of violence as well. He got into a lot of fights. And it's later been suggested down the line that he may have had antisocial personality disorder, and people believe he was potentially suffering from PTSD at the time that he committed this crime. The reasoning behind that belief is he had got involved in a lot of fights, and he'd been involved in a number of assaults that he'd been subjected to. The most recent assault had happened in September 2020, and it was a terrible assault. He'd been hit with a hammer. He'd even been stabbed in the face with a screwdriver. So he could have been killed. Also, we have to bring in at this point, we already have somebody who's got some poor impulse control. Of course, you've seen that from the crimes I've just talked about him being engaged in. The fact that he's got a relatively chaotic history, he's not been able to sustain education, he's in lots of fights that he's actually chosen to get in, but also he's the victim of these fights. We can kind of see that before we even arrive at this violent assault, there are issues with his impulse and consequential thinking. Imagine getting hit with a hammer and then stabbed in the face. That could well have caused some kind of brain injury. Think about orbital cortex damage, for example. Just any of those areas of impact on the brain can severely change behaviour. I'm not giving him an excuse. I'm saying if you're ever going to add fuel to the fire of possibility, stroke probability, of somebody's behaviour declining further, well, these kind of injuries are clearly going to have an impact. And that's before we explore the fact that people say that PTSD was part of the issue. Anybody out there who's suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, of course, one of the things that we see is that some people escalate in violent behaviour. They are reactive. They are on high alert. They feel a sense of panic and dread about the environment that they live in. Therefore, they overreact to certain stimuli. And if that's additional to all of the things I've just talked about, then this man is going to be somebody who has a huge amount of problems, but a huge amount of potential and probability even for getting into some serious scrapes. And I say that really minimizing what we're going to talk about today. Another thing, Askew had a massive problem with drugs. So any of you who have come to my Serial Killer Next Door tour, or any of you who've watched some of my videos, you know where I cover these things? The ingredients list for creating a violent offender has certain experiences in childhood through to adulthood that you can, shall we say, look at and imagine contributed to the circumstance that they're in that moment in time. So we've already talked about criminality, violence, problems with his education, getting involved constantly in fighting and all the things that go with that, but also drug dependency, big problem for people who've already got fractures in their personality, maybe in their upbringing, certainly in their psyche when we add all of those things up, because it distorts reality. And some people can take drugs quite happy recreationally for the rest of their life and never have an issue. Genuinely, it would be remiss of me to say anything otherwise. There'll be lots of people who smoke cannabis on the daily. There'll be people who take ecstasy at the weekends, people who like hallucinogens, even people who self-medicate their depression with things like psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms for those of us who grew up in the 80s. But what happens in certain people is that drugs have a huge impact on the way that they process the world and the way that they react within it. And the more that they take drugs, the more it skews their reality, the more it impacts on that behavior, and the more problems that it additionalizes when you already have these existing issues. And he was somebody who engaged regularly in recreational and heavy drug use. He also grew cannabis in his house. So likely it was a consistent theme in his life that he was smoking on the daily. On the Thursday, the 22nd of April, this is 2021, so it's a very, very recent crime, this. The evidence of what I've been talking about, of Askew's violent, volatile nature, emerges. First off, he argues with his girlfriend. So we can imagine when you're already in a mindset where there's conflict and you have a volatile personality and maybe you're under the influence and your nearest and dearest relationship is turning sour in that moment, it can cause you to feel a real anger and rage about what you feel is unjust in that moment. And if you can't resolve it with your partner, sometimes that can make you switch your behavior elsewhere. And it seems like this happens. So at one point, after he's argued with his girlfriend, he turns on Chloe. Now remember, Chloe is the daughter of David's partner. And bear in mind that David treats her as a daughter. And when he turns on Chloe, he gives a warning that is really strange, considering what I've told you about the fact that David and Askew are basically considered close friends, and Askew considers him his best friend. But he turns to Chloe, and in reference to David, he says this: "Tell your effing lad to stay out of my effing face, because I will effing kill him." Now,
Legends, the greatest social casino experience, has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
This, everybody felt, was unusual, because Askew didn't see David in this way at all. And I think when you look at how crimes play out, you look for the origin of where this experience begins and how it escalates. And this is origin. This is unusual. David is not considered the enemy by Askew usually. He's not even involved in this situation right now. And yet Askew is giving Chloe this very dark warning. But of course, people who know them are going to see them as really close friends. There's not been any warning signs in their relationship that Askew has an issue with David. Even for Chloe, this would be a bolt out of the blue. It's very easy in that moment to think he's just having a bad day. He's just talking rubbish, and you don't really take heed of those concerns, particularly when it's so outside the realms of reality of what you see normally in the relationship. But this is a really honest, if you can ever use the word honest and Askew in the same sentence, warning. He's not just saying this. There's something in his psyche that has shifted in his view of David. No one else has seen it. No one else has a clue of what's going to happen. But it's like Askew knows. There's something that has shifted and changed. Maybe at this point we're starting to be introduced to a level of paranoia in Askew's personality. Even though David is Askew's closest friend, he's suddenly in the spotlight for harm. Gets to Friday, the 23rd of April, 2021. Earlier in the night, David and Askew had been hanging out together. This is really common. And they'd been at Lisa's house. This is in Esh Winning in Durham. They'd been there with the partners and they had all been drinking, they'd all been taking recreational drugs. Think that when we bring recreational drugs into crimes, it can be really easy to judge people, to say, well, if you haven't been intoxicated in that way, A, B or C would not have occurred. But remember, lots and lots and lots, in fact, millions of people take recreational drugs and they do it for fun. They don't expect that anything terrible and tragic is going to play out. Otherwise, the vast majority of people wouldn't do it. Certainly, what we're talking about here is friends getting together and getting high and partying. And they've done that many, many, many times before. So even though they are putting things into their body that change the way their bodies interact and react, this is not something that's unusual for this group of people. And even though they are under the influence, again, that's representative of millions of people all over the UK and billions probably all over the world every single weekend, because recreational drugs are part of our culture. In the early hours of Saturday, the 24th of April, 2021, David, still with Askew, well, they leave together because they decide that they want to go to Askew's place to get some speakers. It's not unusual, particularly when you're high. People make decisions that are impulsive and seem desperately important at that moment in time. They're not. But you know how it is when people, you may have been around, have taken drugs. Certainly I've encountered it where I'll be around people who are under the influence and I'm really straight-headed. I'm one of those people who doesn't even drink alcohol on the whole when I go out. But obviously, in the past, I've been around lots of things growing up. But nowadays, when I'm in scenarios where somebody is conversing with me, and even if they haven't told me, I can just tell by their over-enthusiasm about micro details that really don't matter, where they're like telling me that they need to do something in that moment. It always gives me that insight, because my husband used to run club nights because he was a DJ, and I would be on getting kids home duty, like anybody who's under the age of 30 feels like young to me. And if somebody got really in a mess, whether they were drunk or whether we felt that they were under the influence, we had a taxi duty. So we would make sure that people were sent home in a taxi. We weren't one of these individual clubs who would run a night and then literally put somebody on the street and expect them to fend for themselves. The consequence of that is as well that you end up speaking to lots of individuals who are having a great time and they are just telling you all this stuff and they are really enthusiastic and they're trying to drag you over to get you a drink. And you can see that that's not how they would normally be. But add recreational drugs to the mix and that's how they are. So David would set off with Askew with that enthusiasm, without a doubt. And Chloe goes with them. So Chloe at this point isn't afraid. Lisa's own daughter is quite happy to go with them to Askew's. And she was the person as well, remember, who was warned by Askew about how they need to watch David. Because, you know, clearly he's saying something bad potentially could befall him. So they've surely at this point, just reading into that situation, got little fear about what might play out. For Chloe, for David, walking into that house that evening to retrieve those speakers didn't feel abnormal whatsoever. But what's about to play out? Firstly, neither of them could have predicted. But secondly, it's going to turn Askew's home into a house of horrors. Once they get in to Askew's home, as opposed to just retrieving the speakers and leaving, David and Askew decide that they're going to do some more lines of cocaine. Chloe says it's at this very moment she sees a switch. She can see that there is a change in Askew's behaviour. On one level, we could say, well, okay, they've taken some more cocaine. This is obviously adding fuel to the fire, and Askew may not be in the most positive of mental states anyway, and suddenly he reacts out of the ordinary. But we can't, because Askew has already let Chloe know in a previous conversation out of the blue that David potentially is in his line of fire. So is it that Askew's behaviour changes because of the cocaine? Or is this just a way that he uses this moment to pivot to his true plan? Because Chloe said almost instantaneously, he turned nasty. Also, the reason that Askew apparently uses a situation that's playing out at that moment in time to give him an excuse for turning nasty is because David has basically asked a really simple question. Not one that's unusual at all. He just asks Askew if he can see his cannabis plants. It's a completely innocent comment. You've got a mate, they're growing some weed. You're interested in how they're doing it. You're interested in seeing how they're progressing. You ask a question. I mean, we're not talking about the fact that Askew is some kind of multi-millionaire drug dealer. We're not thinking this is somebody who has a huge amount of money available to him because of this massive drugs industry. This is just a homegrown scenario. No big deal. But for whatever reason, Askew apparently chooses to see this differently. And I'm saying chooses to see this differently on purpose, because apparently he becomes instantly paranoid. And he decides, when David has said, can I see your cannabis plants? Let me look at your weed growing, that David is going to steal his plants. Also, I'm not going to deny, we can say that he'd been on a serious drugs binge. So clearly Askew is not in his most positive and clear of minds. He'd been on a serious drug binge for 2 days. We also know from what we've been told from the courts is that he consumed a large amount of alcohol. He'd been consuming cocaine and amphetamines. Also, earlier in the day, he'd actually managed to acquire a bag of amphetamines from a friend's house. And people said that he was swallowing the amphetamines by the spoonful, which is, one, very dangerous. Just a tip out there. Don't swallow spoonfuls of amphetamines. It's a very quick way to give yourself a heart attack, for example. But it also tells us another story. He's not consequential in his thinking, as we noted earlier on. He hasn't got that much regard for his own safety. That's why he's ingesting this level of potentially lethal drugs. So is he going to really regard anybody else's life as that important? If you can't value your own, then obviously you can transfer that potentially onto other people as well. But he's had this massive cocktail of drugs. And the belief is that this cocktail of drugs caused drug-induced psychosis. When you experience drug-induced psychosis, it can make you aggressive, it can make you very scared, it can make you do things that onlookers can find really bizarre, such as you might believe that you are Jesus, you might feel that you can take off all your clothes and run down the road and that you would be invincible if a car hits you. It sends you into a really weird space mentally. Psychosis can make you heavily suspicious and heavily paranoid. And if you're suspicious and paranoid and you believe that somebody is out to harm you or get you, clearly this can make it dangerous for the other person that you are around. Now, to make it worse, Askew already knew that this kind of level of drugs cocktail was basically lethal on his behaviour. So whilst it didn't kill him, it killed any tiny fragment of morality that was running through him, because he had been there before. It had happened on more than one occasion in the past. It had impacted on his mental health really, really seriously, and he'd actually been admitted to hospital on 3 occasions, which had been following these episodes of drug-induced violent psychosis. So when you have the evidence that if you do this, this will be the result, and you go out of your way to literally still engage in that behaviour, as opposed to avoiding it, you know what the results are going to be. On this day, he just went ahead and he did it anyway, in spite of knowing what that could mean, both for himself, but also for the people who he was around. This paranoia is something that runs within his veins to some degree. And further evidence of this very paranoid personality, that day at least, was clear in the interactions that he had with Chloe. He would look at Chloe and say that she was looking at him funny, and she wasn't. She was obviously trying to avoid looking at him because she didn't want to incur any wrath, and she could see that he wasn't operating in the world how he should be operating. Also, he started claiming that there were other people in the house, and he started with this really paranoid belief system that they were all making a fool of him, they were all humiliating him, and that he could see their shadows. So he now builds in this picture that to some degree he's under threat and everybody's laughing at him. Must have been incredibly scary for Chloe. Bear in mind, she's probably starting to piece together what she's heard him talk about before as regards what he wants to do to David, because certainly he'd suggested that David needed to watch out. He might be in line for some harm. But now she's trapped in this guy's house. This guy's making out that there are other people in the shadows who are humiliating him. And he's getting really paranoid about David accusing him of wanting to steal the cannabis plants. She would know that this is absolutely a cooking pot of possibility that is going to go in a very dark direction. So this being convinced of David wanting to steal his cannabis plants really fuels this anger. So it's following these completely irrational, by the way, allegations that Askew believes that David deserves punishment, without a doubt. Now, one could say in that psychotic state, he's looking at self-preservation and protection, so Askew is acting on an impulse where he believes he is under threat. I don't believe that for a minute. Not at all. Bear in mind, we still have that thread between what Chloe experienced in her conversation with Askew and what I'm going to talk about now. And the fact that he'd got David to his home, they'd taken more coke, and then a really innocent conversation about David seeing his cannabis plants is all it takes to spark these highly irrational allegations that permission-based Askew's behaviour. And that's what I believe is happening here. This permission base is being created. Askew wants an excuse to beat David, and he needs to find a peg to hang the coat on, so to speak. Now, bear in mind, David is absolutely intoxicated himself. He can't defend himself. Also, he is not a violent person. He's known to be the absolute opposite of violent. He doesn't want a fight. This is one of his closest friends. He can't defend himself anyway because he's really drunk and really high. He's really scared as well. Why wouldn't you be? But most importantly, this will not be expected. It's just a bolt out of the blue. Somebody that he likes, that he spends time with, that he and his partner hang out with his partner. They're a group that usually get on. This, for David, is something that he would not be prepared already for. Even though it starts and he can see that this is going to be a really violent assault, I don't think for one minute that David could even imagine for a millisecond what's going to happen this night. But this initial assault, where David already can't defend himself, it's just going to get increasingly violent as time passes. And genuinely, I can tell you now, the only reason in that moment that Askew allows himself the excuse to hurt David is because of that conversation about the cannabis plant. That was all it took. The violent assault begins with Askew first pushing David onto the couch. Chloe, of course, firstly, she's a young woman. She's absolutely terrified. She feels completely helpless. She's sat in the corner of the room. So after he started to push David onto the couch and be aggressive, he then goes and retrieves a bayonet. Now, people of my age, we know what bayonets are. But for those of you who are like, what is a bayonet? What is a bayonet? Is a bayonet some kind of net that you use in a bay, for example, to bring in fish? No, it's not. Was used in things like the First World War. So basically a bayonet is like a machete type weapon, and it has often a gun with then like a stabby knife on the end, and obviously it's incredibly dangerous. And that being brought in for Chloe would instantly trigger absolute terror. What on earth has he done arming himself? He also brings in a long-bladed silver kitchen knife from the kitchen. So she can see there is clearly really negative intent that is going to be directed towards David. He doesn't actually use either of those weapons initially, but it's the taunting that begins. So he's pushed him onto the couch, then he's trying to humiliate him, then he's trying to goad him, then he starts jumping on him and, you know, Askew is meaning to do harm. We're not talking about a bit of roughhousing between mates. We're talking about a violent perpetrator aggressing an innocent victim. When he was attacked by Askew this way, instantly he starts getting severe bruising. In fact, he had fractured bones because of that assault. Then Askew gets up and he closes the curtains and he says to David, I'm going to chop you up. I mean, you can't even begin to get your head around how that would sound and feel. You're completely intoxicated. You feel helpless. You've now been very badly assaulted. Your essential daughter, stepdaughter at least, is over in the room. You know that she's in danger. And you're being told by somebody that you considered a really, really close friend that you are going to get chopped up. And he's closed the curtains in preparation. And you're so under the influence yourself that you're confused because nothing's making sense on top of the fact that you're hearing all of this material. You don't have the mental wherewithal because of the influence of drugs and alcohol. But then Askew gets up and he opens the curtains. And he actually says to David words along the lines of, F it, everybody that walks past will see what I'm going to do to you. Now, what I said earlier on, guys, that consequential thinking just isn't there, isn't it? The fact that he isn't trying to disguise what he's about to do, that he wants people who walk past to be able to see what he's inflicting on David. It's at this point, once he's opened those curtains, that the attack is just relentless. So he attacks David with a knife, with a machete, and initially he strikes David across the back with the blades of both the knife and the machete. And you just have to imagine, don't you, the size of what a machete is like. It's terrifying. You can literally cut somebody's arm off with them. And he's getting struck with these blades. But even though he's getting kind of hit with them, then it moves on to stabbing. He stabs him with the weapons. He repeatedly chops and stabs his head and his body. Then he starts kicking him in the head and the body. David is just trying to get up. But every time he tries to get up, Askew is just ordering him back into the corner of the room. And bear in mind, Chloe's there. She's witnessing this. But David also knows that if he doesn't comply, potentially, with what Askew is doing, Askew could turn this on Chloe. During this brutal attack on David, who is much loved by Chloe, she's just being made to sit and witness it. He's chopping and he's slashing at David's back, and Chloe's just doing her best to cover her eyes. There is no other thing that she can do aside from try to protect herself from the horror that is playing out. She's powerless. She is helpless. She can't bear to watch. The only way she can slightly protect herself is to blind herself from the images. She hears the cracks as Askew brings the blades down on David's body, and she hears him repeatedly jumping on him. And she also sees Askew just directly kick David in the head. And all she can do is beg. She just begs Askew to stop. She just is desperate to find a way to intervene. to prevent what is clearly becoming more and more sinister and dangerous for David, a man that she loves. At this point, Askew says that his plan is not to kick David's head off. Instead, he wants to chop it off. He says that once he's chopped off David's head, he'd throw it at her. David's listening to this. He's listening to Chloe's pleas. He's listening to what Askew is saying his intentions are. And the intentions are becoming more and more clear, aren't they? Askew's letting David and Chloe know that David will not be leaving that room alive. During the attack, David cries out that he's being stabbed. He's repeatedly begging for Chloe to call him an ambulance. He knows his life is in severe danger. He can feel his life ebbing away. He just wants the emergency services to turn up and save him. At one point, he begs with Askew, please, I won't tell anybody. Nobody needs to know what you've done to me. I just need to get some help. I'll tell the paramedics that I've been in a motorcycle accident. He just is desperate to be saved. That's how severe the extent of his injuries were, that even he knew in that moment in time that he was so severely injured that he'd have to tell them, if he was going to lie per se, that he'd been in a serious motorcycle accident. But just the fact that he's trying to create that connection with somebody that he considered a friend, saying, I won't even tell them that you did this. Please, just let me leave. David was, at this point, horrifically injured. And yet, in spite of these heinous injuries that he suffered, he still tries, at one point, to escape. He tries to get out from the back door. But, of course, Askew is wired, raging, and enjoying the abuse that he's inflicting on David. So he's stopped by Askew. They found extensive bloodstains in the kitchen. That's evidence of the escape attempt. And what Askew did was he tortured them in so many ways in this circumstance. He tortured them, obviously, physically with David, on a witness level with Chloe. But when Askew stopped David from leaving through the back door, what he did, he removed the broken handle from the back door to make it clear that neither of them could get out of the house. So he's even torturing them with that knowledge that they are essentially at his pleasure. There is nothing they can do. He also kept hold of the only key to the front door. And you see, that again is something that tells me that even though he's going through this psychotic break, well, he has the wherewithal to stop people getting out of the back door and to prevent them leaving through the front. So he's aware of his surroundings to the point where he can plan to prevent these individuals leaving. That makes me feel that he's a lot more conscious to some degree of what he's doing than one may give him credit for when thinking about the amount of drugs and the impact on his mental health. Bear in mind, at this moment in time, we have Chloe. She's trapped in the room. She's witnessing, listening, seeing this attack. Askew had actually pushed her onto a chair in the corner of the room. Also, to stop her leaving, he threw chairs towards her to make it difficult for her so she couldn't escape. At one point, he pushes this large table up against her and he traps her against the wall. I imagine, without doubt, she thought that she was going to too be a victim of Askew, that she too was going to end up just like David. Every time she tries to get up, and she did try to get up time and time again, he just pushes it harder and harder into her. And he tells her that if she moves, David will be struck again with the machete. So she is an absolute prisoner. What could she do? Every time she moves, he hurts her. She can see that he's absolutely got the potential to kill. She's not going to be sitting there thinking, oh, maybe I can overpower him, maybe I can fight him. She's looking and thinking, if I do anything, either David's going to get attacked even more drastically, even more dangerously. And I will be the reason for that, because he's warned me, if I do anything, David will be attacked. Or he's going to kill me. She must have been absolutely horrified and petrified. She repeatedly begs Askew, stop, please, stop hurting him. But he's disinterested. Instead, he actually says to Chloe, no, you know what? You watch what I am doing. You watch what I am doing to David, to this man you consider a stepfather, to this man who loves you. You watch, and if you don't watch, I'm going to do exactly the same to you. For Chloe, that is an impossible threat to manage, isn't it? Either watch or you'll die like this. And at the same moment, every time she opens her eyes, the images of David are being scorched into her memory. A trauma that she'll never, ever be able to unsee. A vision that will always be burnt into all of her thoughts about the man that we're talking about today, David, the much-loved partner of her mother. She's having to witness him at a point in time where he is just in such a state. He's covered in slash, stab, chop wounds. He's bleeding from his arms, from his legs, from his head, from his back. And she says at one point, she lifted her head and she saw Askew just swing the machete down, and it made this really heavy contact with David's head and then with his legs. He then kicks David in the face. She's watching this. Chloe's desperate. She wants to just, even though she's putting herself at horrible risk, try to save him. There's a mobile, her mobile, on the table. She reaches for it. But again, you know, this man who's apparently completely out of his mind, he's an individual who's having this psychotic break, but somehow he's had the wherewithal to take Chloe's phone to remove the battery so it's disabled. And he even sees her reach for that phone. And when she does, even though he knows that he's already made it so she can't use it, he goes for her with the machete, chops at her hand. Now, thankfully, she manages to pull it back, but otherwise she could have lost her hand. Then Askew jumps on the table. He's got his machete in his hand. And as he does that, he does actually cut Chloe on the leg. And he then says to her, you are lucky. It was just your leg that's been cut. So he's letting her know, I am willing to harm you. I am willing to cut you. And Chloe's just sat there, terrified, defenseless, watching a man that she loves bleed out, knowing that unless help comes soon, David will not be leaving that room alive. And it's not as if Chloe can create a ruse to get away, because when she wants the toilet, he won't even let her use the toilet. He has absolutely no intention of laying her out of his sight. So there's very little that she can do apart from sit there without knowing how she can change that situation and circumstance. She notices that David tries sitting up again and again, but every time he does, Askew just hits him, strikes him, stabs him again and again. And this is a stage where David is critically injured. This has been sustained. This has been going on for a long time now. Chloe said that she could hear that his breathing was laboured. He's trying to catch his breath. It's like he's struggling. Now, in addition to the obvious injuries that you can imagine from the weapons, he's also got fractured ribs, really seriously fractured ribs, because he's been stamped and jumped upon. I think to anybody who's listening who's ever broken ribs, I have broken ribs, and it is breathtakingly painful. It makes breathing really difficult. And we're talking about a man who has got so many fractures and he's struggling now to even breathe. And then what's just heartbreakingly sad, but also poignantly clear about where David was in his pain, in his suffering in that moment, he actually asks Askew to just kill him. He just wants Askew to end the suffering. That in itself tells you so much. By this point, that...
Hell yeah! L-E-D-E-N-E-T.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Attack that I've been talking about, this brutality that is hard to conceptualize, to imagine. It's been going on for several hours. Can you imagine the pain that he's in? The blood loss, the fear for Chloe, the confusion, all of these things just happening all at once. You can't imagine the agony that he's been going through. And psychologically, what we know about the average, typical human being is that when you are faced with a circumstance where you are at risk, where you may be deeply injured, or you may be at threat, or you may be stuck in a terrible situation, survival instinct is unbelievably powerful. We've seen examples of people cutting off their own limb when they are trapped because the survival instinct of doing so bears more weight than the laying back and acknowledging your death. For David to be in a place where he's pleading for his aggressor, for his perpetrator, ultimately for his murderer, to end his pain, it says it all, doesn't it? Around 4 p.m., two of Askew's friends basically turn up at his house. This is Craig Dixon and someone called Ozzy. They're standing outside the window and they're looking in. And they can just see Askew's in this blood-stained shirt, is holding this machete in one hand. He's got a knife in the other. And then they notice that there's a young woman in a chair in his home. And also they can see David and he's slumped in the corner. They can tell that he is literally drenched in blood because he's wearing this grey tracksuit and it is literally covered, seeping in blood. And also there's blood all around him. So they can see it's a protracted attack and this man is bleeding out. Truth is, by 4 p.m., that time that they find him, it's likely that David was probably dead at this point. And if he wasn't dead, he was definitely on the verge of death at that point. Apparently, he'd long since fallen into unconsciousness. This would have been down to the blood loss. And even though Askew had carried on the attack, at no point could he have retaliated. He couldn't have tried to fend off the attacks because he was completely helpless. He was completely unconscious. Craig Dixon, who's just looking at this horrifically macabre scene, shouts through the window, "What have you done? Open the door." But then Askew refuses to open the door, saying, "No, I've lost my key." So instead, he ends up opening the side window. At this point, Chloe becomes hysterical. And she's repeatedly screaming, help me, get me out of here. She runs to the window. She must have been absolutely horrified, terrified. This man has got two weapons. He's basically murdered a man in front of her. How does she know that she isn't going to get stabbed and machete attacked as she's just trying to get out? But the men manage to pull her outside to safety. She's hysterical. And the only thing that she is thinking about is that she wants to escape. She's absolutely terrified that Askew's going to chop at her other leg as she gets dragged out of the window. So once she's out of that house, she just runs. She just runs. She knows that she needs to get as far away from the scene that is unfolding as she can possibly get. Those men looking into that scene obviously are met with chaos and horror. Now, one of them reacts very differently to the other. Because Ozzy, who's looking in at this dreadful scene, in spite of the fact they've also just seen a witness, so I think we can honestly say that Ozzy isn't the cleverest tool in the box. Because, just going to throw it out there, Ozzy, your suggestion, and this was his suggestion to ask you, well, we'll just cover up the crime scene. Yeah. Seems like a completely reasonable suggestion, Ozzy. I mean, I think you just dragged a woman who's witnessed the entire crime through a window. She's legged it, no doubt going to ring the police. She's not going to be like, oh, I'm so glad I escaped that scene. I'll have a cup of tea and some breakfast and get on with my day. I'll just put it to the back of my mind and forget it. Literally, you could not cover that scene if you, I don't know, one of the fixers out of Reservoir Dogs. It's not possible, is it? You can't clean that scene. You're not in a scenario where you're in Hollywood and you're in, I don't know, a Quentin Tarantino film where some person walks in with a gang of people, like in John Wick, for example, and suddenly the scene of the crime is all sorted. It's not going to happen. No, Ozzy, it's a stupid suggestion. But that's what he says. He's like, we'll just get this sorted. No one's going to notice all the blood all over the floor or the corpse that turns up. But clearly, only he thinks this way. Even though he's suggesting, let's just move the body, let's clean up the scene. Craig Dixon, from the get-go, is just an all-round good guy. And this is scary. Because remember, Askew is armed. He's absolutely got form. They can see a body. So they know that he's very, very dangerous. But Craig Dixon, on hearing Ozzy suggest what they could do, was like, no, we're not doing that. We're going to do the right thing. We're notifying the authorities. He actually calls 999. And he stays on the phone to emergency services for nearly 20 minutes. And this is all the while he is trying to help David. Now, initially, he didn't want to go in the house. I appreciate that. Who would want to go into the house of an apparent crazy individual who is armed? The carnage that he saw must have been horrifying. He's got Askew stood in front of him holding two really serious weapons. And as Craig said to emergency services, that this guy that he knew, this Askew, was acting really strange. And he tells the call handler this. He's covered in blood on the floor. I've just come to the house. He's on the floor. There's blood all over him. And then he says that he'd appeared that the person who'd been attacked had been stabbed. Then he added, I've just seen him through the window. He's a mess. The call handler asks him to go in to perform CPR because she wants, or he wants, who was on the phone at that moment in time, to ensure that David is given at least the best chance of survival. Craig, unbelievably, and courageously climbs through that window. How incredibly brave of him was that? Think about going in there, crawling through that window. Yes, the window he could always escape from again, but it's difficult. The door is locked. There is an armed and dangerous man, and he's actually going to go and try and help the victim that this person has chosen to kill, hardly ingratiating himself with the perpetrator. But he does it anyway. He tells the call handler that David is actually still warm, but he's not breathing. So he's then advised to do CPR. He lies David flat on the floor and he follows those instructions that she gives to him over the phone. At this point, he attempts to perform CPR and he can describe to the emergency service call handler that there is air and blood coming out of David's mouth. At one point, he actually says to Askew, can you take over? Because he'd done it. So he's saying, you've created this carnage. You sort it out. And ironically, Askew actually does take over for a short time. That break in the scenario, because these men have turned up. And one of these men, who is clearly a contender when it comes down to being more alpha, so Askew is potentially on the back foot now because this man has firstly, to some degree, shown that he isn't afraid of Askew. He will have been terrified. But because he's told him, no, stop, because he's called emergency services, because he's literally come into the home and started performing CPR and then he's telling him what to do, he kind of takes control of the situation. And that changes the way that Askew is dealing with the scene playing out. So essentially, this hero who gets involved in this scenario starts calling the shots, and in doing so, he removes Askew's power to some degree. The police and the ambulance arrive at 5:05 p.m. Officers instantly smash the window to get access to the house. Paramedics take one look, basically, at David and say there's absolutely nothing that we can do to save him. And they really did give their best efforts to do so, to try to help, but he was pronounced dead at the scene at 5:20 p.m. Askew at that point is arrested by officers. And if it's not bad enough that Chloe had been through probably the most horrifying, tragic trauma that she will ever deal with in her world and life for the rest of her life, she initially also gets arrested. So this poor victim, this woman who has ran off horrified, terrified after witnessing somebody that she loved be brutally murdered, she's arrested. She ends up getting kept in custody for absolute hours before they actually realise that she was a victim too. So that adds insult to injury. Why they decided to arrest her as a suspect, one can only imagine because she left the scene of the crime. So they're not thinking this woman has ran off genuinely thinking that she's going to meet her own death. They're thinking she's tried to escape because she's guilty as hell. But it wouldn't have taken very long to assert that her mother was David's partner and that she herself had been a victim. But it takes hours of her being in custody. When they look at the injuries that David has sustained, oh, well, I mean, I've talked about it, haven't I? So you are going to expect that these are horrific. He had sustained 60 external injuries to his neck, head, body, arms, and legs. At least 40 of those injuries have been caused by a sharp weapon, and that sharp weapon had been used to stab, to chop, to slash David. Also, they found other injuries that they think related to the back of the blade. So he was being hit violently with the back of that blade. They found a lot of defense wounds as well. So the injuries to his arms in particular showed that at some point David had been trying to stop the attack and had got seriously injured because of that. He'd suffered 6 broken ribs, which would have been agonizing. He had really heavy bruising on his back. As I've said, he was being kicked, he was being stamped on. He had very severe, extensive internal bruising that, again, would have been to do with him being stamped on and being kicked. The pathologist who had to make an assumption about what had actually concluded killed David was that there had been a combination of factors. So, as I said, when those men turned upon the scene and realised that Askew had done this, the first thing that drew their attention was the fact that there was blood everywhere. So a serious loss of blood, which had been caused by a multitude of wounds, certainly played a significant factor in him dying. But he'd also inhaled vomit and he had a collapsed lung, which is why when Chloe was listening to him towards the end of his life, she could see that he was struggling to breathe and he was making some very laboured breathing sounds. Askew, of course, is bang to rights. He's at the scene with the weapons, with the person he's murdered, and there's a witness who spent the entire time there until those men, by God and by chance, turned up. So there is no escaping that he is the main perpetrator and the only perpetrator in this violent crime. So he's charged with David's murder, and he's also charged with Chloe's false imprisonment and assault, occasioning ABH, due to the injury that he inflicted on her leg, obviously, because it's clear that she was a horribly victimised individual in those circumstances. And because of all of this, he goes guilty. You'd have to, wouldn't you? You couldn't potentially, under any circumstances, say it wasn't you, that you hadn't carried it out, because everything points to you, including you being literally caught at the scene with the weapons. So he pleads not guilty to all charges. Not guilty. I am not guilty basically of anything. I'm not even me. You know, I can't be me. I'm somebody else, so I wasn't there. I imagine that that's how his brain works. So whilst in prison, Askew ends up speaking to the DART team. Now, for those of you who don't know, it's a service that's the drugs and alcohol recovery team. And he gets a support worker and therefore starts engaging with them about the brutal murder. But it's not as if he's acting remorseful. It's not as if he's trying to suggest that he's come to his senses and has reasoned that what he did was despicable. His callousness is unbelievably clear because he's just able to describe, and I mean in intricate detail, guys, in intricate detail, the ever-increasing amplification of violence that he inflicted on David. So he's able to tell the worker that as far as he was concerned, David was trying to steal from him. And he actually says, no effer is getting their hands on my plans. He doesn't realize who I am. Really, Askew? Well, you're not Pablo Escobar, are you, Petal? But obviously, there's a bit of a grandiose complex there, shall we say. A little bit of superiority. He doesn't realize who I am. We do. You massively murderous, hideous excuse for a human. But he's certainly not playing it down what he's done. He says to this DART worker that what he'd noticed was that some of his skunk was missing. I'm sure you all know what skunk is, but basically it's cannabis. And he's decided that this has disappeared. And therefore he has decided to direct that anger at David, saying that he is probably the person who's taking this skunk. He then tells this worker that he slashed David several times so that he could literally stop him physically taking the plants, but then says, didn't mean to kill him. Didn't mean to kill him. I don't think you just struck him several times though, did you, Askew? I think you tortured him for hours using many different objects, including a machete and your feet and a whole heap of other implements to torture your apparent friend. He says he didn't mean to kill him. Really? You didn't mean to kill him? Again, you denied him help. Chloe wanted to ring emergency services. You threatened her. And you made it very clear throughout, including when you said you wanted to cut his head off and throw it at Chloe. Not going well for you on the didn't mean to kill him, it was an accident type rhetoric. But then he goes on, in spite of saying that he didn't mean to kill him, that at some point during the attack, he thought, F it, so I stabbed him in the head. Askew sounds like such a delightful human being, doesn't he? Somebody who shows remorse and understands the consequences of his actions and recognises the requirement of accountability if you are ever going to better yourself, full stop. But taking you back to the very beginning of this, this is a man who doesn't really care about the future. This is a man who's been heavily criminalized already. This is a man who doesn't fear the system. We have a big problem if somebody doesn't fear a system. Because if you don't fear the system, you certainly aren't concerned about the consequences when you breach that system's code of morals or ethics. The trial occurs at Newcastle Crown Court. That's the 12th of October 2021. Apparently, by this point, he'd expressed some remorse for David's death. You know, hadn't at all. Had gloated about the way that he'd murdered his said friend. Felt as well that, you know, it was appropriate to murder somebody because they'd nicked a bit of skunk. Let's even put it in the ballpark that David, who definitely didn't, by the way, stealing his skunk. Well, let's just throw it out there. Let's throw it out there that David had stolen some skunk. I don't know. Some strong words. Refusing to be friends with them anymore. Asking for them to pay for said stolen skunk. All of these are possibilities and should be on your priority list of how to deal with conflict, as opposed to, I think he stole some skunk. I'm just going to murder him. But this is where Askew's head is. And what a surprise that by the time it gets to court, it's like, I do feel sorry. Do you? Do you really feel sorry for David's death? Or are you just thinking this is probably what you need to say because you realise that society, juries, and of course the courts, we don't like viewing people like you lightly when you don't show any level of understanding for your actions. He apologises to his victim. He apologises to David's family. He also apologises at this point to his own family. And he does, at this point, accept that he's responsible for inflicting fatal injuries. I'm not going to give him any excuse here at all. You don't have to have more than an ounce of intelligence to realise that when it comes to you, bang to rights, being caught in situ, having no reason for the actions you've carried out, having witnesses, both the girl, poor Chloe in this case, seeing it all play out, and the guys who arrive on the scene, you know there is no way you are escaping the possibility of a sentence. So you're always going to think, how do I minimise it? I'll just apologise to the family. I'll just say, you know, I don't really mean it. I've let myself down. I've let you down. And worst of all, I've let my community down. You know, we've all heard that kind of BS. Now, the judge would actually back what I've just said. The judge was like, okay, I've listened to your apology. And I don't believe it. Thank you, judge. Clearly a good judge. Because he said, all you're doing is you're trying to seem genuine because you want to get a reduced sentence. And I kind of feel like a judge who feels that way is like, and because you think I'm stupid, I'm going to up your sentence. That would be the kind of judge I would be. It's why I could never be a judge. Because they'd be like, I'm sorry, Emma. It's not okay for you to give this bike thief life. He's stolen 30 bikes. He's been in court 28 other times. The last two bikes he stole, I said, if you do that again, you're going down for life. Yes, Emma, but you can only give him a 12-month custodial sentence. God damn it! But that's why I could never be a judge. Now, ask you again, in spite of this apparent resolve to care about impact, he just denies that he was guilty of the murder. He's like, I am really sorry. I'm very sorry to all of you. And I may have been there and done those things, but I didn't actually murder him. Ugh. It genuinely makes me wonder whether they go to a special school of stupid when they come up with these excuses and reasoning behind why they are somehow not culpable for the crime that is clearly being committed and has been committed and has been recognised as being committed and even has witnesses to it being committed. But, you know, a lot of criminals like this go ahead and just try their best to do as much damage control as possible to ensure that they get a lesser sentence than they absolutely deserve. So Askew claims on the day of David's death, he and David had just been getting along fine. We're getting along absolutely fine. Okay, I might have said those weird things to Chloe about him needing to watch it. But you know, we're getting along fine. It was fine. Anyway, he alleges that when they get back to his house, that's Askew's house, apparently David went funny. Apparently he started asking about cannabis, also apparently asking about money in his house. So Askew was completely convinced he was going to tax him. For those of you who don't know what tax means, it means rob from him. So getting taxed means getting robbed. So he believes that, you know, he has to protect himself. So the way that he does this in the first instance, he tells David to just leave. Okay, well, that would be reasonable. That would be one of the suggestions I would have made earlier on when it came down to other opportunities to deal with this situation. If you thought somebody was being weird with you or stealing from you, just leave. But even though apparently he says to David, just leave, David, the man who has never been known for any violence, has been a good friend to Askew, is loved by everybody, is seen as a non-conflictual, non-violent person, just, you know, picks up a machete. David's like, yeah, that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. I could just leave, but instead I'm going to completely act out of character and, I don't know, find a machete in the house and just threaten Askew with it. So he says that that's what happens. David picks up this machete and Askew, of course, has absolutely no other opportunity whatsoever than to act in self-defense. And apparently at some point, you know, he just, the classic, loses control. Things just get out of hand. I would like to be the prosecution in this case. I know that loads of you will feel that way, but you know when you get one of these really clear-cut cases and you sit there and you're like, I would just love to cross-examine this person. Because let's just think about that scene. So first of all, he says that he told David to leave. Then he says that David picks up the machete. So somehow he then has to defend himself. Well, Chloe's there. She could ring the police. Oh, hang on a minute. Chloe can't ring the police. Why can't Chloe ring the police? Oh, yeah, because you've disabled her phone so she cannot call the emergency services and you put a table against her so she can't move. So at that point, it's going to be so easy to absolutely pull to pieces this man's defence. The overwhelming evidence did not support for even a millisecond, not a millisecond, the version of events that Askew is putting forward. And one of the most obvious is that Chloe was sat watching. Chloe was literally watching the death of David play out in traumatic technicolor. So he was never going to get away with this version of events, but this minimizing, this trying to make out that this very gentle man who had never done anything to harm anyone, that they were the individual who deserved the ramifications of their behaviour, in this case, daring to ask about cannabis and money. Askew actually trying to suggest that it was he, David, who'd made the first attack by picking up the machete. So then Askew goes on to try to plead the special partial defence to murder. Now, the reason that these are special is, firstly, you can only plead them to a murder charge. And they are partial because if you plead them successfully, you aren't actually acquitted, but instead you get convicted of the lesser offence, and that lesser offence is voluntary manslaughter. Obviously, though, that impacts on the length of sentence. Now, the two special defences are diminished responsibility and loss of control. When it comes down to diminished responsibility, what the defence tried to do is they tried to suggest that Askew was basically suffering from an abnormality of mental functioning. And they said that this was caused by a recognised medical condition, and that that medical condition substantially impaired his ability to understand his conduct, form a rational judgment, or exercise self-control. Not being funny, guys. I wasn't at the trial, but what I'm presuming he tried to claim within that was the fact that he'd had a psychotic episode, right? Because a psychotic episode would be a recognised medical condition which definitely substantially could impair his ability to exercise self-control. So it might not have been witnessing that particular case play out, but I think that's the only thing that he could have gone for in the way that they were trying to play this defence. However, I also doubt with respect that a self-induced psychotic episode caused by an individual choosing to take a load of drugs would count as a recognised medical condition. It would be a voluntary medical condition that one has imposed on the self, as opposed to somebody who genuinely suffers a break from reality because they have a medical diagnosis of psychosis because of a mental health issue. That in itself, we could argue, could cause this kind of break from reality, which would fit this condition. But that's not what we're talking about here. Also, whilst the drugs that he took would definitely have had an effect on his behaviour, oh, come on, he absolutely knew what he was doing. He didn't lose control. Just based on the simple evidence that we see, such as removing the handle from the back door so that nobody could escape. He kept hold of the front door key, trapped Chloe with the table and with the chairs. Also, he demanded that Chloe watched. He was telling David what he was going to do to him next. He was telling Chloe what he was going to do to David next. So absolutely, under no circumstances whatsoever does this register with me in my experience, and also with anybody with an ounce of common sense could possibly believe that this was an individual who didn't have the ability to exercise self-control. So at this end, we cannot agree. David was murdered by somebody who was not substantially impaired. He wasn't. Askew was absolutely aware of what he was doing. So even though the defence are arguing this point, we can see that Askew has self-control over this situation and circumstance, thus meaning doesn't fit that category. The prosecution, of course, and rightfully so, they argue that Askew had absolutely voluntarily consumed drugs. In particular, he had been consuming amphetamine, and he was absolutely aware of what that would mean. He knew, because of his previous experiences, what occurred to him when he took large amounts of amphetamine. He had on previous occasions become very dangerously and violent. In fact, he had been violently psychotic 3 times in the past. He knew, if I do this, this is the consequence. Now, if Askew failed with the diminished responsibility defence, the other thing that he hoped may play in his favour was this other special defence, which was to show that David's murder was a result of a loss of control. Now, in law, that loss of control must be caused by a qualifying trigger. So that qualifying trigger would be Askew suddenly fearing for his life or fearing that he was going to be a victim of serious violence, or he'd have to be in a seriously provocative act, or maybe a combination of the two even, and that a person of Askew's sex and age with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint and in the same circumstances might have reacted in the same or similar way. So it's not just about meeting the level that Askew was in a circumstance where somebody threatened him, made him really, really afraid, and he reacted in a certain way. It has to be that they look at another person and go, okay, well, could we expect if another human being went through exactly the same as Askew, the resulting behaviour would follow? Which is bizarre, because we all know that loads of us will have been in scenarios where somebody has been utterly reprehensible. They might have harmed us, they might have hurt us, and we haven't then, albeit when we felt really threatened, tortured them for hours and hours, made a witness watch, and then murdered them. So even though he thinks that this potential special defence is going to work, at the end of the day, flimsy is not the word that fits this at all. Not even flimsy is going to describe it. It just, in my opinion, is a non-argument. Askew also claimed, of course he claims the classic, I don't remember the attack. I don't remember the attack, and therefore I must have lost control. How would I not remember this if I was in anything but a circumstance where I was out of my mind? Because otherwise I would recognise what I did. But this is completely contradictory, because during his police interview, he was actually really adept at describing in detail what he'd done to David. And also, he didn't just lose control. People do lose control. Look, crimes of passion occur. People do reprehensible things in moments of deep regret as well in the future. And they act outside the realms of ration and their normal reality. That doesn't happen for several hours. Askew inflicted serious harm and then eventual death on David for several hours. He inflicted a prolonged, sustained attack. Ultimately, the jury have to go off and think about whether those special defences are appropriate. And they were like, no, they're not. I'm going to reject both of them, probably in about 30 seconds. 1st of November 2021. He's found guilty of David's murder and, of course, Chloe's false imprisonment and assault, occasioning ABH. So completely bang to rights. He's absolutely guilty. No consideration given to him at all. As far as they are concerned, murder is the only possible sentencing. So on the 10th of November 2021, Judge Alison Cousins sentenced Askew, and he faced a mandatory life sentence for David's murder. But the judge then has to, of course, establish the minimum term that he would serve before being eligible for parole. The starting point when this is considered can be substantially increased for cases that involve torture, which clearly this did. But surprisingly, the judge found this was not a case properly described as of wholly exceptional brutality. What crack are you smoking, sweetheart? Let me just go through that again, guys. The starting point for deciding these sentences, which means you can substantially look at the term and increase the term before the person's going to be ever allowed out for parole, they have to look at the case for torture and they have to see whether it was considered wholly exceptional brutality. And the judge was like, no, it doesn't meet that. What? What? He was tortured for hours, macheted, stabbed, stamped on, beaten, and then murdered. If this case does not fit that, well, I would hate to see one that was. Now, don't get me wrong, the judge did say that the lengthy suffering that was inflicted on David was an aggravating factor. No, Sherlock. Really? Was that an aggravating factor? Sometimes I take it back. I should be the judge in these circumstances, shouldn't I? Because I would have been able to look at the actual definition of what I've just described and be like, yeah, absolutely fits that. You know, not only is the aggravating factor the length of the torture that occurred, another aggravating issue is the weapons, the extreme violence involved, also the fact that Askew had voluntarily taken a lot of drugs, and the fact that he knew that those drugs would have that kind of...
L-E-T-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Kind of impact on him. David's state was another aggravating factor because that meant that he was not in a position to defend himself. He was a vulnerable victim. And further aggravating factors was the fact that, like, Askew had a list of prior convictions as long as my home. Several of these were for possession of weapons, so he'd got form regarding violence, and he'd also been subject of a suspended prison sentence when he committed the murder. So he couldn't even keep in line with the provisions that were made for him on the license that let him have a suspended sentence as opposed to being in prison. That suspended sentence had been for criminal damage and assault, as I said, of an emergency worker earlier that year. When it came to mitigation, the judge did acknowledge that Askew had a troubled childhood. They said that he'd had aggressive tendencies, aggressive behaviour and behavioural difficulties from a really young age. He had childhood conduct disorder, and they believe that that had progressed to an adult personality disorder. So we'd be looking at antisocial personality disorder. Or as a lot of us just like to go, psychopath, massive, violent, aggressive, narcissistic psychopath. Also, he had evidence of BPD. We can say that borderline personality disorder can obviously affect impulses, but genuinely, the idea of even throwing BPD in there as if somebody with BPD would be violent and aggressive and murderous kind of boils my blood a little bit, because people with BPD have often had very traumatized upbringing. Yeah, okay, they can't regulate their emotions in the way that they might wish to, but they're a lot more likely to hurt themselves. And, you know, as I always note, it is possible for murderous criminals to have things like BPD and bipolar and a whole range of other mental health issues, but the reality is that statistically, even murderous criminals can develop these. They're still murderous criminals. That's the thing that's wrong. not the mental health issue. Anyway, moving on from that, it just annoys me. It is worth noting, though, that even though the BPD was brought in, the judge did say that that wasn't why he carried out this horrible crime. It was caused by voluntarily consuming loads of drugs, and apparently during a psychotic episode, he acted out, but they noted that this psychotic episode was not one where he wasn't aware of what he was doing. Like, he did know what he was doing. And part of that testimony that was used against him was the fact that he did think about concealing the weapons and moving the body afterwards, because that guy who turned up suggested they could. So that shows that he wasn't completely out of his mind at all. When it came to sentencing him, they gave him life with a minimum of 24 years for David's murder, plus 4 years for Chloe's false imprisonment. They also gave him 3 years for the assault on Chloe with the machete that had caused her leg wound. And these sentences were to run concurrently. That means he'll be 58 years old when he becomes eligible for parole, which I think is a pretty light sentence when you think about what he did. After delivering the sentence, the judge praised Craig Dixon. And I think we can all agree that Craig Dixon is a pretty inspirational human being for what he did. You know, the fact that he wanted to try to save David, the fact that he put himself at risk by trying to save David. The judge also praised Chloe and said that Chloe Richardson had endured the ordeal of the actual experience of being violated in the ways that she was and the trauma of seeing David die, but also that she'd been willing to be there at the trial, to be a witness, to ensure that the justice was done, that David got his legacy, knowing that this man will not be walking the streets. Chloe's victim impact statement was read out in court. It described the psychological impact that she'd suffered. You know, she can't get David's cries out of her head. She can't stop hearing him begging for her help. She sees horrific, horrific scenes in her sleep. She suffers from flashbacks and nightmares, and her mental health has been seriously affected. And she's had to understandably seek professional help. In fact, you cannot imagine an individual who could go through something so heinous who would not require professional help. It is just unbelievable. It's the kind of thing that veterans have PTSD over when they've turned up at places where, let's say, death camps have occurred in other countries. You know, these horrific groups of individuals have gone and macheted whole townships, women, children, and men. This is the kind of thing that they see and then come home and can't cope with. And they're individuals who've chosen to some degree to put themselves in the line of fire. Chloe's just this innocent young girl, and she's had to witness this, so of course she's needed to seek that professional help. She said in her victim impact statement, "I still find it difficult to process he was murdered by Robert for absolutely nothing. I think I will be coming to terms with what I saw Robert do for the rest of my life." And I'm sad to say, I think that that's an accurate summarisation of where she will be. David's poor mother, she had to bury her youngest son. It's something that absolutely not one of us as parents ever wants to have to do. I mean, it's just terrorising. But add to that the fact that she's buried her youngest child, and she's buried him knowing the incomprehensible, senseless, pointless nature of his death and the brutality of that death, living with knowing that she could not prevent her baby dying in such a heinous way. David's older brother, meanwhile, he's just plagued with guilt. He just can't believe he wasn't there to protect him. Survivor guilt is one of those things that so many people feel, and it's so sad because they don't deserve it. Because the truth is that David's older brother would have absolutely been there and showed up. He just didn't know. He'd have risked his own life for his little brother, and yet there he is burdened with the guilt because he wasn't aware of this psychopathic individual with this malicious intent, this murderous intent. David's best friend, Amy McGigan, she spoke of her absolute utter devastation over his death. She said, we spoke to each other on the phone at least once, sometimes twice a day. He'd never put the phone down without saying, I love you. And I was the same to him. I haven't slept. I just feel like I'm suffocating, just waiting for someone to tell me. It's all lies. So full of life. He loved his children. He'll always be loved and missed by everyone he knew. He was an all-round cheeky lad who wouldn't hurt anyone. That ramifications, the ripple effects of loss that literally changes and challenges the lives and the futures of all those affected. I took some time to just look at homicides in the UK. And according to information that's held with the Home Office, that's the Homicide Index, there were 594 homicide victims in the year ending March 2021. And when I looked into it, the most common method of killing was by a sharp instrument. So there were 235 homicides committed using a knife or another sharp instrument. More than half of all the homicide cases resulted from a quarrel, a revenge attack, or a loss of temper. The killings themselves were most likely to take place in or around a house, dwelling, or residential home. So I imagine a lot of us will understand, well, yeah, if you're in a domestically abusive relationship, most of those kind of homicides happen behind closed doors. But it also demonstrates that, for the most part, a lot of these murders take place in environments where people would usually feel safe, you know, when they're around their friends and in familiar environments. In the last 3 years, almost a third of homicide victims were thought to be under the influence of drugs and alcohol, or either, at the time of the homicide. And when they look at homicide suspects, so people who were considered the ones carrying out the crime, over a quarter of them were either under the influence of alcohol and drugs, or drugs at the time of the homicide. So it demonstrates that the more you add these kind of variables to the mix, the more likely the outcome can be catastrophic. This crime was one of those that I researched and really made me think about how something so innocent as a night with mates can turn into something so utterly catastrophic. And when I think about David, I think about this forgiving, compassionate, loving, good man. Yeah, like all of us, he was imperfect. Like all of us, he probably wished he hadn't taken drugs that night. Certainly would probably think that he wished he hadn't been compassionate or understanding to a man like Askew, somebody who had a criminal conviction history that made him a very dangerous type of human. But that's the thing about certain people in the world. We don't judge people as harshly as they deserve to be judged. And David is clearly one of those. He had a friendship with Askew in spite of who Askew was. And that's testament to a man who was kind and good and generous. And yeah, he liked taking recreational drugs. But under no circumstances whatsoever can that give leverage or excuse to the end that he met. He was just an innocent victim in the wrong place at the wrong time, being used as a vessel for a man to take torture out on him merely because he wished to do so. It was never about cannabis. It was never about money. It was never about anything else than Askew wanting to cause serious, great, and ultimate harm to an innocent man. David's family miss him massively. And of course, like we always do in these videos, this is about them having to rebuild their lives, re-navigate their experience, and come to terms with the gaping wound that Robert's loss has left in the family unit. Murder is a truly terrible thing that lasts a lifetime for those who experience the loss of a loved one to it. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
L-E-D-E-N-E-T.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.